What happens when society strips young women of their power by convincing them they're dangerous? Kim Liggett's haunting dystopian novel, The Grace Year, explores this question through a brutal coming-of-age ritual where 16-year-old girls are banished for a year to release their supposed magic. The book has garnered widespread acclaim since its 2019 release, with Universal Pictures securing film rights before publication and Elizabeth Banks set to direct. Celebrities like Reese Witherspoon have championed it through book clubs, comparing it to Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale and William Golding's Lord of the Flies. Liggett's story resonates deeply in our current cultural moment, offering a powerful allegory about female agency, societal control, and the revolutionary potential of women supporting one another rather than tearing each other down. In Garner County, an isolated traditional community in the remote wilderness, young women face a pivotal transition during their 16th year. According to local beliefs, they must complete a ceremonial year of separation to prepare for their future roles in society. This practice, known as the Grace Year, involves a period of reflection and transformation in a designated wilderness area. Those who return often display physical and emotional changes that spark curiosity and speculation among younger community members. The narrator, through careful observation, notes the subtle differences in those who complete their grace year, from changes in their demeanor to various acquired markings that become subjects of quiet discussion. The annual Veiling Day ceremony marks a significant milestone where returning grace year participants are formally introduced into adult society. During this elaborate celebration, families present their daughters in traditional white attire as they prepare to establish future households. The narrator finds herself matched with Michael, the influential son of the community's leader, an arrangement that creates social tension, particularly with Kirsten, another prominent young woman who had anticipated this match. This elevated social position brings both advantages and challenges as the narrator navigates changing relationships with her peers. The narrator experiences recurring visions of a distinctive figure, a strong-willed young woman with cropped hair and a unique birthmark who challenges traditional practices. These private thoughts must remain carefully guarded as the community strictly regulates personal expression and independent thinking. Women who display unconventional behavior face social consequences and potential exclusion from the community's inner circle. As departure day approaches, the narrator observes subtle acts of resistance within her seemingly conformist society. Her mother, typically reserved and traditional, secretly adds a meaningful red ribbon flower to her clothing, a small but significant gesture of solidarity. The narrator also witnesses a profound incident involving an outsider caught in the community's defensive measures. Though she attempts to provide assistance, she must watch as community laws are strictly enforced, leading to severe consequences for the trespasser. This experience raises questions about their society's practices and reveals the presence of outside threats that the Grace Year participants must consider during their time away. These elements combine to create growing uncertainty about the established order as the narrator prepares for her own Grace Year journey. The 33 Grace Year girls are transported to a remote encampment surrounded by an electrified fence, their new home for the next 12 months. Beyond the barrier lurk poachers, ruthless men who hunt and kill the girls for their body parts, which are believed to contain powerful magical properties that can be sold on the black market for everything from beauty treatments to potions promising eternal youth. The girls quickly establish a social hierarchy, with Kirsten, a charismatic but cruel leader from a wealthy family, as their self-appointed authority. When the narrator dares to question Kirsten's increasingly arbitrary and harsh rules, she faces immediate retaliation. She's branded a traitor and banished from the group, forced to survive alone in the unforgiving wilderness with minimal supplies and no allies. What follows is a harrowing tale of survival that strips away every comfort and certainty the narrator has ever known. Through brutal trial and error, she learns to distinguish edible plants from poisonous ones, builds rudimentary shelters from fallen branches and leaves, and develops techniques to move silently through the dangerous forest. Her discoveries are often chilling, scattered bones and decomposing remains of previous Gracier girls who never made it home, their bodies left to rot where they fell. Some show signs of violence, while others appear to have succumbed to exposure or starvation. Meanwhile, within the encampment, a disturbing transformation begins. The remaining girls descend into a collective madness that manifests in increasingly violent and erratic behavior. Former friends turn on each other with savage intensity, driven by paranoid delusions and inexplicable rage. Through careful observation, the narrator uncovers the source of their deteriorating mental state. Hemlock silt, contaminating their water supply, a toxic substance that induces hallucinations, paranoia, and aggressive behavior. Have you ever seen them fly? Have you ever seen them disappear before your eyes? Have you ever seen them do anything but die? The narrator asks herself during a moment of clarity, fundamentally questioning the existence of the magic they've been taught to fear since childhood. This pivotal realization that the magic is nothing more than a carefully constructed lie used to control and subjugate women becomes the cornerstone of her growing resistance against the county's oppressive patriarchal system. The wilderness, despite its dangers, becomes a paradoxical space of liberation. While constantly threatened by armed poachers, dangerous wildlife, and the harsh elements, the narrator experiences true autonomy for the first time in her life. Free from the county's suffocating social constraints and constant surveillance, she begins to think with unprecedented clarity. Every day of survival strengthens her conviction that women's supposed magical powers are a fabrication designed to keep them fearful and compliant. In the forest solitude, she discovers her own strength, not supernatural, but deeply human, and begins to imagine a different kind of future for herself and the other women of her community. After nearly freezing to death, the narrator is rescued by a poacher named Riker. Initially terrified he'll kill her for her body parts, she's surprised when he tends to her wounds instead. She discovers that Riker has a connection to her father, who secretly treats the women and children of the outskirts. Riker had promised to spare her if given the chance, explaining that the knife he'd thrust through the fence earlier was meant to warn her away, not harm her. As she recovers in Riker's treehouse shelter, their relationship evolves from captor-captive to something deeper. He reveals shocking truths about the county. The poachers are sanctioned by the county itself, paid to deliver the girls' flesh back to their own people. Your fathers, brothers, husbands, mothers, sisters, they are the ones who consume you, not us, he explains. The poachers who return with kills receive gold enough to take their families west and escape. This revelation forces the narrator to confront the horrifying reality that the county's prosperity and power structures are built on the literal consumption of young women. The Gracier isn't just a ritual of control, but a systematic harvesting of female bodies, a brutal metaphor for how patriarchal societies exploit women's youth, beauty, and reproductive capacity. As the narrator heals, she and Riker develop genuine feelings for each other. He teaches her survival skills and shares stories of his mother and six sisters, not blood relatives, but banished Gracier girls his mother took in. Their growing intimacy represents a different kind of relationship than what awaits her in the county, one based on mutual respect rather than ownership. When the narrator eventually returns to the encampment, she finds the girls in dire condition. They're starving, hallucinating from the poisoned well water, and Gertie is near death from an infected wound where Kirsten violently cut off her braid. Using knowledge gained from Riker and her father, the narrator begins healing the girls with clean water, medicinal herbs, and nutritious food from a garden that miraculously sprouted from seeds sewn into her cloak, a secret gift from her mother. To maintain control over the increasingly unstable situation, the narrator cleverly uses the girl's belief in magic to her advantage. She presents herself as someone who can communicate with the ghosts of the dead girls, gaining their trust while slowly introducing truths about what happened to those who didn't survive. This strategic manipulation allows her to gradually wean them off the poisoned water without triggering Kirsten's violent opposition. As the girls recover their physical and mental health, they begin to remember the atrocities they committed while under the influence of the hemlock. This reckoning forces them to confront their complicity in each other's suffering and create space for genuine connection and healing. The narrator observes, "Looking at these girls around the fire, I wonder how they'll reconcile their actions when they return home to become docile wives. Will they remember the horrors, or will the hemlock-laced well water blur everything into a hazy dream?" This question gets at the heart of the book's exploration of collective trauma and memory. The Gracier system persists partly because the survivors either forget what happened or choose to remain silent about it. Breaking this cycle requires not just surviving, but remembering and speaking truth to power. The narrator and Riker's relationship deepens as they meticulously plan their escape, spending stolen moments mapping routes through the wilderness and discussing survival strategies. Their dream of finding sanctuary on a remote island where magic and femininity wouldn't be feared becomes their shared beacon of hope. They imagine building a life where they could live openly, free from the county's oppressive laws and watchful eyes. Their carefully laid plans crumble one foggy morning when a rival group of poachers ambushes them. The attack is swift and brutal. Riker fights desperately to protect the narrator, taking on multiple attackers at once. Despite his skill and strength, he's overwhelmed. The narrator watches in horror as a blade finds its mark, and Riker falls. His last words to her are "run," a final act of sacrifice to ensure her survival. She flees through the forest, her heart shattering with each step, barely making it back to the encampment alive. In the depths of her grief, the narrator experiences a profound transformation. Rather than letting her loss harden her heart or drive her to seek vengeance, she channels her pain into protecting the other girls. She realizes that escape isn't just about physical freedom, it's about breaking the psychological chains that bind them all. The transformation of the camp becomes their collective act of defiance. The girls work together, turning their prison into a sanctuary. They scrub away years of accumulated fear and hatred from the walls, arrange their beds in an unbroken circle, mirroring the secret gatherings of women in the outskirts who dare to maintain their ancient traditions. This new configuration symbolizes their unity and shared strength, a physical representation of their growing sisterhood. The destruction of the punishment tree becomes their most powerful act of rebellion. This grim totem, decorated with the gruesome trophies of past Graciers, braids torn from scalps, severed fingers and toes, extracted teeth, had long stood as a warning and a reminder of their subjugation. Together, they take turns with the axe, each strike a rejection of the violence and fear that defined their Gracier. When the tree finally falls, they transform its stump into an altar of resistance, adorning it with wildflowers, daisies for innocence, lavender for peace, and solitary blooms representing individual strength. Their nightly ritual at the spring becomes a sacred ceremony of remembrance and healing. Under the waning moon's gentle light, they share stories of the girls who didn't survive, not just from their year, but from all the Grace years before. They speak of June's quiet defiance, of Michael Sester's dreams, of countless others whose names had been erased. The narrator leads them in these ceremonies, understanding that remembering is itself an act of rebellion against a system that wants them to forget. As they prepare for their return, their solidarity becomes their shield. They know they'll face challenges ahead, but they're no longer the frightened girls who entered the Gracier. They've become warriors, sisters, survivors. Their march home will carry the weight of their transformation, a quiet but unmistakable declaration that change isn't just coming, it's already begun. The survivors' return to the county is a stark reminder of the system's brutality. Only 15 of 33 girls have survived, making this the bloodiest Grace Year in history. The narrator watches with sorrow as the new Grace Year girls file out, looking so young and innocent, like dolls being dressed for a dance rather than for slaughter. In the town square, men with veils take their places to claim their brides. Michael stands before the narrator with a gardenia in his lapel, the flower of purity. But she has a shocking revelation to make. She unbuttons her cloak to reveal her swollen belly. She's pregnant with Riker's child. The crowd erupts with accusations and calls for punishment. Someone throws an orange lily at her, the flower of hatred and disgust. As the crowd screams for blood, the narrator notices her mother lifting her skirt to reveal a jagged scar on her ankle before being dragged away. The revelation hits hard. Her mother was the woman caught in the trap before Veiling Day, and she's been the mysterious usurper the county has been hunting, secretly meeting with women of the outskirts to offer comfort and hope. In this moment of crisis, Michael unexpectedly claims the child is his, saying the narrator came to him in dreams. The girls from her Grace Year stand with her one by one, and she notices red flowers pinned secretly on women throughout the crowd, women who've been part of the resistance all along. This display of female solidarity forces the county leaders to back down, though they twist the situation to justify the Grace Year more than ever. Michael takes the narrator as his wife, providing protection for her and her unborn child in a society that would otherwise shun an unmarried mother. Their relationship begins on uncertain ground, weighted by her raw honesty about her enduring love for Riker. Yet over time, they develop something perhaps more meaningful, a partnership founded on deep mutual respect, shared values, and a common desire for change. Michael demonstrates his commitment to reform by taking over the town's apothecary, where he systematically works to dismantle the Grace Year system from within. His most significant act is burning the cabinet containing the supposed Grace Year remedies, effectively cutting off access to the toxic substances that have harmed generations of women. The narrator's world expands further when she uncovers an intricate network of women working in secret to challenge the county's oppressive systems. During a private moment, her mother reveals the truth about the mysterious gatherings in the woods that coincide with the full moon, the very scenes that have haunted the narrator's dreams since childhood. You'll receive a flower as invitation, but not until the baby is born, her mother explains, describing a resistance movement that has operated in shadow for generations. These women have created their own underground society, passing down not just knowledge and hope, but practical strategies for survival and reformation from mother to daughter. The birth of her daughter proves especially difficult, with complications that nearly claim both their lives. When the child finally arrives, the narrator immediately notices a distinctive strawberry mark below her right eye, the exact mark she'd seen in her recurring dreams on the face of the girl who boldly proclaimed, "We are the weaker sex, weaker no more." In naming her daughter Grace Riker Welk, the narrator combines elements of loss, love, and hope for the future. As she holds her newborn, she whispers the words that feel both like prophecy and promise. She's the one who's going to change everything. This moment transforms the recurring dream from mere premonition into a powerful mandate for change. The narrator finally understands that the magic the county fears and tries to suppress isn't the dangerous force they claim. Instead, it's the profound and unbreakable connection between women across generations. This power lies in the quiet inheritance of resistance, the sharing of forbidden knowledge, and most importantly, the revolutionary potential that emerges when women choose to support and uplift each other rather than submit to the enforced competition that has kept them divided. Through her daughter, the narrator sees the culmination of countless small acts of rebellion and resistance, all building toward a future where women might finally break free from the cycles of violence and control that have defined their existence. The Grace Year ultimately reveals how patriarchal systems maintain power by turning women against each other. By convincing girls their emerging sexuality is dangerous magic, the county ensures they enter their Grace Year already fearing themselves and mistrusting one another. The poisoned well water exacerbates these tensions, driving the girls to violence and preventing them from recognizing their common oppression. The narrator breaks this cycle by questioning the fundamental premise of the Grace Year. Her journey from complicity to resistance illuminates how systems of oppression rely on the silence and participation of the oppressed. When she chooses to help the other girls rather than abandon them, she demonstrates that solidarity is more powerful than individual survival. The novel's use of flowers as a secret language among women emphasizes how resistance can flourish even in the most repressive environments. The tiny red blooms that appear throughout the story, pinned to clothing, growing where bones lie, passed from hand to hand, represent hope that persists despite attempts to crush it. Like seeds waiting for the right conditions, revolutionary ideas can lie dormant until the moment is right for growth. The book ends with ambiguity. The narrator closes her eyes and sees Riker in the woods, waiting to see if he'll embrace her or pass through her. This uncertain conclusion suggests that while the work of dismantling oppressive systems may not be completed in one generation, each act of resistance plants seeds for future change. The narrator's daughter, bearing the strawberry mark from her dreams, embodies this promise, the culmination of countless women's sacrifices and the beginning of a new story. The Grace Year persists partly because survivors either forget what happened or choose silence upon return. The hemlock-laced water serves a dual purpose. It makes the girls violent during their banishment and clouds their memories afterward, preventing them from questioning the system. The narrator's decision to remember and speak truth becomes a revolutionary act. By creating a detailed record of who died and how, the narrator ensures these girls won't be erased from history. When she and the survivors bathe together and share stories of every fallen girl, they transform individual trauma into collective memory. This act of remembrance becomes the foundation for resistance. They cannot change what they cannot name. The novel suggests that breaking cycles of oppression requires both remembering past injustices and imagining different futures. The narrator's recurring dream of women gathering in rebellion represents this dual vision, looking back at a history of resistance while looking forward to its culmination. When she discovers her mother has been part of this underground movement all along, she realizes her dream wasn't just prophecy, but inherited memory, passed down through generations of women who refused to accept their subjugation. In naming her daughter Grace, the narrator reclaims the term from those who used it to justify women's banishment. Grace becomes not the magic that must be purged, but the strength to endure suffering and still choose compassion, the courage to remember when forgetting would be easier, and the hope that sustains resistance across generations. The tiny red flower her mother slips into her hand as she releases her from the black ribbon in her hair symbolizes this passing of the torch. The resistance continues, flower by flower, woman by woman, until the day when all are free.